I'm Kurt, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm appreciative that Danny has asked me to tell my story. And one of the things that helped me along the way, I've shared my story a number of times since I came into AA, joined the fellowship. And one time I was going to go tell my story at NABA, and a buddy of mine that I've known since I came into AA, I talked to him pretty regularly. I was talking to him on the way over there, and I said, I'm going to tell my story tonight. And he says, oh, are you? And he says, well, remember, you're not the subject. And I said, really? And he says, yeah, the subject is the disease of alcoholism and how it's manifested in your life. And after he told me that, when he shared that with me, I really took that to heart, and it's made sharing my story a lot easier because the subject, it doesn't have to be me. And I love what was read, what Lauren just read about anonymity and the absence of ego. And when I got sober, there was a saying that I used to hear in meetings, which is that we leave our pride, our pocketbook, and our pedigree at the door because it has no place in AA. And I didn't really understand it at the time, but as I've stayed sober and I've experienced the nature of AA, which is a very loving nature, and it's an understanding of what we suffer from in this disease, drunk and sober, those outside issues, the things that the window dressings of the human being really kind of fall off when we're sharing honestly with one another about what we're up against with this thing. And so I love the anonymity aspect of AA, and not simply the part of not telling somebody that someone is an AA, but the spiritual aspect of that, where everything falls off. And it's just a language of the heart. You know, it's us sharing. And we kind of get into a zone. And it's a very meditative experience coming to a meeting for me, because when I'm listening to another alcoholic and I'm relating to what they're sharing, it frees me. It does something for me. And I heard it described like this, that when two alcoholics get together, I'm powerless. I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over how things unfold. Things unfold without my permission or without my approval. They just unfold. And realizing that, or coming to accept that, it's an incredible thing to share with another alcoholic, because there's a power that happens between us that I don't have, that releases me from caring about things, making a big deal of all the stuff, taking things seriously. You know, the Rule 62 part of the message of AA. And so hopefully that will happen tonight. I started drinking at a very early age, and I got sober at a very early age. Alcohol was swift and powerful in my life, and it became all-consuming for me, and it was the most important thing once I started drinking. And the first time I took a drink, I had no idea what I was doing, but I stole a fifth of Canadian R&R from my dad's liquor cabinet. The seal had not been broken on the bottle, and I was going to go camping with my buddies in my friend's front yard. And we lived in a neighborhood where there was woods and long driveways, and it felt like we were in the woods, but we were in my friend's front yard, and we were 14 years old. At that time, I was headed toward a college experience. I was living in a upper middle class neighborhood. It was in Ohio. I'm from Atlanta, and I grew up in Atlanta, but I lived in Ohio for a short period of time. I went up to Ohio to learn how to drink, and I learned how to drink really well in Ohio. And this is what was happening. And I had lots of friends. I had a pretty good relationship with my family. I had was doing well in school. And then I stole that bottle of Canadian R&R, and everything changed at that point. Got in the tent with my buddies, and I broke the seal. I took a swig of this very strong liquor and passed it around. And my friends either drank it or they didn't drink it. Some of them did. Some of them had a swig or whatever. And then that was it. And then I continued to drink it, and I drank the whole bottle. I blacked out. And I was in, it wasn't a full blackout, but it was a time travel blackout where I was in one place and then I'm in another place and then I'm in another. One of those places was this girl that I couldn't talk to up until 3 a.m. that night. And I walked into her house, walked right into her bedroom. Started trying to work my mojo on her. I was 14. I didn't really know what mojo was, but I was in there trying to talk to her. And my buddies came in. They found me, and I tried to hide under the bed. Half my body's out and under the bed, and not under the bed. And boy, we think we're clever when we're drinking, right? That night, there was a couple other things that happened, which I have shared one time with one person. And I won't share during this meeting, but very embarrassing. And then I got shot in the foot that night, and and my drinking was downhill from there. Had a 2-day hangover. It was pretty nasty. The aftermath of it, just typical throwing up and all of the things that we go through, but. I stood up to the bully in the neighborhood that night. All of the things that the fears were gone. The courage was in there. And I had, after the first day of my hangover, I realized I had needed some surgery on my foot. And I jumped up and I realized I had been shot in the foot. Nobody knew that I had been shot in the foot, including myself, until the booze wore off and the pain ensued, and that was it. So the neighborhood had a big meeting around what had happened, what had occurred, and all the parents got together and discussed the situation. I thought I had somehow hidden it, though. My drinking was pretty much the same way the entire rest of the time. This is indicative of the drinking experience. But what was happening internally was, I think, the most profound thing. I mean, I became an instant alcoholic, and I fell in love with alcohol. I had the reaction like, this is the magic elixir of life. And this is the best thing that I have ever experienced, because I had experienced something that it did for me. And I couldn't describe it. I didn't know that this was happening to me, but I wanted more. And I wanted to change my friends. I stopped hanging out with all of those people that were doing something with their lives. And I started to change the way I related to my family. And I lost interest in school. I just stopped caring about all of those things. And alcohol had a hold of me. And I was obsessed with drinking at that point. So I was looking for opportunities to drink and ways to drink. And I was living with my father and his family, and my mother got a divorce, and I moved back down to Atlanta to help her out. In actuality, I just knew that there was going to be a lot more freedom in living with her. And so I moved in with her, and I was drinking as much and as often as I could. I quit going to school, not officially, but physically. I quit going to school, and that caused some problems because I was failing school. And I the drinking was just really I just didn't know that I was getting sicker and sicker. But I drank a lot of tequila and mixed with punch and vodka, and those were kind of my drinks, and Jack Daniels. But I had a problem with hard liquor, because when I drank hard liquor, I usually blacked out. I was a blackout drinker. And so I switched it up, and I started drinking beer. And I was very skinny. And so I drank dark beer because I thought it would fatten me up. And I used to drink Michelob Classic dark beer, which doesn't exist anymore. There have been a lot of alcohol beverages that have come and gone since I've been sober. And I, you know, part of me feels a little robbed. You know, I didn't get to try those things out. But on the other side, this is an incredible gift. There's a duality in me. You know, it's a bittersweet thing to be a sober alcoholic, especially in the beginning. But I really had just checked out of life. And I had come up on a situation, just to kind of describe the effect that my drinking had had on me and my relationship with the people in my life. My grandmother had cancer, brain cancer, and she had had the tumors removed, and 12 years later, she had to have another surgery. And at that point, I was in the throes of heavy drinking. I was, like I said, I was not going to school. I was, I think it was a junior in high school, and I failed that grade. I got all Fs because I didn't attend school. I got a C in sociology, and it just happened to be that my teacher smoked marijuana, and I had a side addiction as well, and I sold drugs. So, but we're in an AA meeting, and I think it's very important to stick to talking about alcoholism and my relationship to that. But my grandmother was about to have surgery, and so we went down to Florida to be there with my family. And when that occurred, my grandmother died during surgery. And while we were down there, all I was doing was trying to find ways to drink, and I was having a lot of trouble with it. It was pretty hard for me to go through that because I was so addicted. And my mom came to talk to me about to break the news, your grandmother has died. And we sat down, and she's sharing with me that her firstborn son, that her mother has died. And I had no emotion. I was completely dead inside. And I had to pretend like I cared. I had to, you know, put on an act. And then I had this great idea that Grandma would want me to go back to Atlanta and go to summer school right now and I'll skip the funeral, but I, you know, this is what grandma would want. And it was just an opportunity for me to get the hell out of there and be able to come back up here and drink the way I wanted to. And that's what I did. But that was the state that I was in. And all of my decisions during my entire drinking experience were predicated on how and when and where I could drink. Things got progressively worse. We had a family friend. When I turned 17 years old, the family friend, he was apparently a psychic, like a fortune teller. On my birthday, he took me to the Cobb County Jail. He was a former police officer, and he wanted to give me a tour as a birthday present. I was like, why is this guy doing this? It was terrifying. I mean, we're walking through, and he's like, these are prisoners, and meet the prisoners. And we walk out, and he says, this is where you're going to end up being now that you're 17 years old. You're going to end up here in the direction you're going in. And he was right. It was amazing. I don't know how he knew it, but he was right. That did happen. I did go to that jail. I got picked up for shoplifting about 9 months later. And I'll tell you guys that story in a minute. But before that, things were so bad with my drinking. My family were doing everything that they could think of to try to get me to stop drinking. They actually had a police officer come and talk to me and try to reason with me. I thought this guy was absurd, and I was like, this guy doesn't get it. I'm just having a good time. My family asked me to sign a contract with them that I wouldn't drink anymore. And I signed the contract thinking I'm just going to have to hide it better. And eventually things were so bad because I had deteriorated so much that I was drinking all the time, and I didn't even care about hiding it anymore from my family. There was one time my mom had a piano, and I had this buddy of mine who drank a lot. He drank more than I did. And I would call him, and we would drink on the phone together. We would get drunk on the phone together. And the drunker I got, the better I was at playing piano. And we used to talk on the phone, and I would play the piano. Ding, 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 ding. We'd start crying. He's like, that's so beautiful, man. That's so beautiful. I'm like, yeah, I know. Isn't it great? I don't know anything about playing the piano. But drinking, I could do anything. And I was stealing a lot, and I was very violent during my drinking. And I had gotten to a point where my mom, she was engaging me in an aggressive way about my drinking pretty regularly. And it had gotten to the point where I was being given an ultimatum. You need to leave, go in the service, or get help, go to treatment. But before I was given that ultimatum, this is what occurred. We were just arriving home. We were fighting about my drinking. And I got so angry, I told her I was going to kill her. And I chased my mom up the back stairs to the kitchen. And when we got there, she shut the door, and I put my foot in the door. And she opened the door and just socked me right in the nose as hard as she could. And unfortunately, that didn't stop me. It just made me angrier. And so the same scenario occurred going up to her room. I chased her up to her room, up the next flight of stairs, and I put my foot in the door, and instead of punching me in the face again, she ran to the corner of her room, and I ran right up to her, and I was going to kill her. And then something stopped me, a moment of sanity, I guess, and I saw myself, and I thought, what the hell are you doing? I was just about to hurt my mom. And I just started crying, and she was already crying, and I put my arms around her, and I said, I don't know what is wrong with me. And of course, we're arguing about my drinking. I was like, what is wrong with me? And that was it. I mean, they just had to get me out of there. It was too dangerous, and they had to take care of themselves. So they had they gave me that ultimatum, and I took the only reasonable option of the three. I left, right? Going to service or going to treatment. Treatment? What? I don't need treatment. And so then this is the point where I started to experience being homeless. And I had a duffel bag with a few items in it, and I was homeless. And I was a high school dropout at that point, at that very moment, because I couldn't, I had to figure out a way to survive, and I was couch surfing, and part of my creative financing was, you know, theft and going to stores and stealing stuff, and I stole all kinds of things, but had this one kind of formula where I would steal a carton of cigarettes, and this is in the 80s, and I got sober in 1986, and so a carton of cigarettes back then was under $10, and I would steal a carton of cigarettes, sell the cigarettes to somebody, and then buy liquor, rather than just going and stealing liquor. I mean, I'm thinking about it now, like, why didn't I just go steal liquor? Anyway. It seemed to make sense at the time, and I got a pack of cigarettes out of the deal. So, I weighed about 115 pounds when I got sober, and I'm 6 foot, a little over 6 foot tall, and I don't weigh 115 pounds anymore. I've increased, I'm twofold, I've doubled in size, but I was really skinny. I wasn't eating. I couldn't afford to eat. I remember when I got sober how hungry I was all the time, because the decisions were being made for me, and drinking was way more important than eating. And this was the point I got arrested. I stole a carton of cigarettes. I was very skinny, and I was real cool looking. I wore a black jean jacket that was cool looking back then. What I would do is take the carton of cigarettes, put it under my armpit, and then put my hand in my pocket. I didn't realize that you could see the corner of the boxes on either side of my skinny bicep. It was too skinny, so they saw it, right? And then I got arrested. I did way worse than that and should have gotten arrested, but anyway, it's the irony of the whole thing. There were several times that I came close to possibly dying, and one of those was I did overdose one time. Another experience I had was before I was removed from the family's home, which was by police Uber combo. They called the police and had them escort me away. And when that was happening, I remember walking toward the police car and looking at my mom, and I flash her a peace sign, and I'm feeling sorry for them because of how terrible they're, you know, what they're doing to their child. Anyway, so I did try to kill myself. I tried to hang myself. and my brother is the one that saved me. I don't know that he actually doesn't know that today, but I pulled myself up when he started to walk in down to where I was, and because I was actually hanging at that point. But I just wanted to turn it off, and that's the state I was in. I don't know if that makes sense or not. I found friends that I could kind of couch surf and live off of a little bit. And there was a guy that I was staying with. I only stayed with him for a short period of time, but I also found a job, a part-time job at a pizza place. And at the pizza place, they served beer. And they had the big tea glasses that I could put beer in. I was a dishwasher, and I put the beer on top of the dishwasher, washed dishes. I got to eat for free. And so this was a great job for me because I was able to, you know, drink and eat and wash dishes and survive. And that's really what it, and I did sleep outside of the pizza place. It was the Village Inn Pizza on 41. Now it's, I think it's a diner, some kind of a diner. It's across from Big Chicken. But anyway, one night, it was about 3 in the morning, or I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 in the morning, this guy was letting me stay with him, and he picked me up. And so we were driving around West Cobb, and the sun was coming up, and I passed out. I had been drinking, and I passed out, and I woke up, and we were bouncing on the other side of the road, and we bounced over a driveway to a gas station and landed on a cliff, and the car was on the cliff. The driver's side was, wheels were suspended in the air, and it, the bottom of the car was flat on the ground. I promise not to tap the thing. And so the tires on my side were on the ground. And I woke up, I looked over at my friend. It was a Trans Am, T-top, cool car. What had happened was he had passed out too. And so we almost went off the cliff. And I got out of the car, and I looked over at the gas station, and I thought, I need some cigarettes. And I looked at him and I said, I'm going to get some cigarettes. You might want to call a tow truck. And he looked at me like I was crazy. I remember the look on his face. And so I went and bought cigarettes, and that was that. The next day, my duffel bag was on at the end of his driveway. And this is somebody I had known for years, with a note saying, go find someplace else to go. So I don't know what I was like from a third person point of view. I know what it felt like to have to drink and the importance of it and that experience. But I've attended Al-Anon meetings from time to time throughout my sobriety. And it's such a revealing thing to think about how horrifying we really are when we're drinking. The Jekyll and Hyde, the difference between us when we're drunk and when we're not drinking, and the uncertainty of being around somebody who's so highly addicted, and I just can't imagine what, you know, what that's like, that even somebody that I was drinking with didn't want to hang with me anymore. And so I found a place to live that was, they were selling drugs in and out of this place, and I was paying $25 a week to sleep on the couch in this place, and it was sort of like the House of Fun. The floors went in different, it was just a falling apart house, so the floors went in different directions, and one night I was up all night drinking with these people. It was a Friday night. Saturday morning came around, the light from the morning started to appear, birds started chirping. It's that horrible feeling that morning after feeling coming down from drinking, and I went into the bathroom of this place, and I looked in the mirror, and it was as if I had never seen myself before, and I was looking at somebody I didn't even recognize. My face was emaciated, my skin was yellow. I had really long hair, and I had glue on my teeth because I had ripped my braces off at some point with a pair of pliers, and I was just very skinny, and I hated me. I was so disgusted with what I was looking at, and it suddenly hit me, I think you have a drinking problem. I don't know why I'm laughing about it. This sounds ridiculous, but it hit me. I had a moment of clarity where I realized that my life was the way it was because of drinking. Before that, I thought I had a lot of bad luck. The world was against me. A lot of hypocrites in my world and all of that. But the reality was that I was very sick. I was a very sick, highly addicted to alcohol person. And I needed help, and I asked for it at that point. I called my mom, who, they had a restraining order against me. So I called her, and I said, I need help. And she could tell there was a difference between that call and the other ones where I was calling and cussing her out, talking about all the, you know, woes of my life and how they treated me really badly. The way this disease manifests itself and the way it treats the people we love, the way we are when we drink, it's just unbelievable. And she gave me a number, and I called the number, and it was a treatment center. I knew nothing about this. This is in 1986. There wasn't a lot of information back then. There wasn't Google. This is the land of landlines. So I called up and I made an appointment. It was several days later. And I called my mom back and I said, would you please give me a ride to this facility? I made an appointment. And she said, sure. So she said, I will not meet you where you are, though. You have to meet me someplace safe. So I met her at a business, like a CVS. And I remember sitting there waiting for her, and I was sober that day. I had drank all the way up till that day because I had to. And that morning she picked me up and we drove over to this treatment center, which is on the other side of Atlanta. It's called Charter Brook. And on the way she said, are you hungry? And I was very hungry. And to this day, it's the best meal I've ever had. It was a value meal at Wendy's, a burger, French fries, Coke, you know. But it was so good because I was so hungry, and my body ached from hunger a lot. This place I was living in at that point, there was no food in the house. It was that kind of a place. I mean, it was not a good situation, very dangerous. I'd had somebody pull a gun on me at some point, Anyway, so we get to the treatment center, and I proceed to interview them about their facility and what they have to offer. I don't know what's going on, but do you have TVs in each room? Is it okay to smoke in each room? Yes, yes. They're lying to me all the way through. It's like a club, a country club. I'm like, what have I stumbled onto? This is a great idea. So I walk out, my mom's outside, and I go up to her and I say, I'm going to go get drunk one more time. I said it more colorfully than that. She explained that to me. When I had 30 years of sobriety, I met her for coffee and we started talking and discussing that experience, that particular moment. And she says, no, you didn't say you were going to get drunk one more time. You said you're going to go get shit-faced. Mm. And I said, that makes more sense. That sounds about right. Uh, And I, you know, I said, I need to go get my important valuables. I had a duffel bag full of clothes that were falling off of me because I had a 27-inch waist and I was skinny. And anyway, so there wasn't anything for me to go get. But she said, okay, no problem. Let me go ahead and handle the arrangements and I'll be back out. And then this really nice woman comes out and says, hey, I'd like to offer you a tour of the facility. I said, okay, be cool. So we go into, we go through steel door number one and down a ramp. And she's like, this is where we eat. And we turn right, we go through steel door number two. This is what we call a unit. And then we go into an office. And I'm like, and there's two big guys standing there at the door. Like, what? I'm like, okay, I got what's going on. So I grab a chair, I'm going to throw it through the window to get out. I'm going to escape the treatment center within, you know, 3 minutes of being in there. And then it just hit me, you're here. This is it. And part of my interviewing process, I broke down and I cried to this woman. So something was already starting to happen. She's lying to me about the television and the cigarettes, but I'm crying. She said, do you need treatment, inpatient, outpatient? And I asked her the difference because I really didn't know. And when she told me, I said, well, I need the inpatient because there is no way I'm going to stop drinking. I need to be locked up. I can't stop. And outpatient's not going to work for me. Plus, you have a TV, and I could smoke in the rooms. And anyway, they put me in a quiet room, is what they called it back then. And then they let me out once they realized I wasn't going to hurt myself or them. And I went to a meeting that night. And the only thing I really remember about the treatment center is the meetings. And that first meeting was when the magic happened. And I know this doesn't happen to everybody when they go to their first meeting or they, you know, maybe a number of meetings, but I think this is something that had to happen for me in order for this to work. And what happened was people were sharing during the meeting, and, you know, alcoholics were talking about themselves and their relationship to alcohol. And I was relating to this honesty, and I felt like the whole world lifted off my shoulders, and I felt like I was a part of and connected to human beings for the first time in a way that I had never experienced before. And you know, the thing that we were talking about earlier about the power that happens between us that we don't have, but there's something that happens. It's like a third mastermind comes into play. Some people might call it God, but it was a moment of relief. And it didn't come from alcohol. It came from you guys. It came from AA, the fellowship, relationship. And I was in at that point. And my head was telling me, no way, man, this is about not drinking. Don't, you know, it was disappointing. I mean, the whole not drinking part of AA was very upsetting, you know, fact. And, but that's how we stay sober. We don't drink. I mean, that's a real integral part of the whole sobriety deal. And, you know, so and so the AA experience has been an incredible thing, but my alcoholic mind has challenged it all the way through early on. And so when I was about to get out of the treatment center, I did go to court, by the way, for that carton of cigarettes thing while I was in the treatment center. And he just slapped me on the hand and said, go about your way. I hope you can stay sober. And so I was real fortunate that that happened. I could have gone to jail for a long time for some other things that I had done. But when I was about to get out of the treatment center, they said, you need to get a sponsor. You need to find somebody that has something you want. And so there was these guys coming into the treatment center, and one of them looked kind of like John Cougar Mellencamp. I don't know if you guys remember that singer, but he was kind of cool looking. And he had these You know, they said, get somebody that has what you want. And he had these snakeskin boots. And I wanted those boots. So I went up to him and I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yeah, I'll be your sponsor. And so when I got out of the treatment center, I called him and he started taking me to meetings and we rode to meetings together. And he was cool. He had a powder blue Mustang. And he went over to Skyline. Skyline was his group. His dad was in AA. He's still sober today. I'm still sober today. So, you know, it works. I mean, get somebody that has what you want. And, I mean, we have no clue how it's just going to unfold. And it just works somehow. I ended up moving over to Tucker, Georgia, and joined the Tucker group. It was my first home group. I was in a halfway house for about 2 years, and that was a good thing for me. I needed time. I didn't know how to function in the world. I was a high school dropout. I didn't know how to keep a job. I didn't know how to keep my mouth shut. I had probably like, I don't know how many jobs. I don't want to exaggerate, but I couldn't keep a job. And sober. And it was great because the people I ran around with would say, man, did you take a drink today? Don't worry about that. You can get another job. Just let's get to a meeting. Don't take a drink. And go start getting interviewed and go find another job. And so that was one of those things that AA really helped me to accept myself slowly over time and to let go of the fight and the need to be in conflict, which was automatic for me. I had an experience with, when I was in the treatment center, there was a requirement to, I'm sorry, in the halfway house, there was a requirement to go to 5 meetings a week. And I was on fire in terms of AA meetings. I loved going to meetings because it did something for me. And it was like a little oasis. I had intense anxiety. I woke up screaming in my mind every morning and just felt riddled with fear. And I would have anxiety attacks. But going to meetings was like this, just this moment of peace. And then it would downgrade it to, you know, intense fear. But the meetings were so important for me, and I went to a lot of them because I was getting something out of it. But the guys that I was living with in this halfway house, they were all professionals. I'm a high school dropout kid. I'm living with a doctor, a lawyer, a pharmacist, and a chef. Mm-hmm. And then there's me, this kid who had no ambition in life until he came to AA, no future or anything. And so one day I came into the house and one of the guys, the chef, said, Kurt, can I talk to you without you getting angry? And I guess I had a little anger problem back then. And I said, sure, gritting my teeth already, ready to fight. And he says, well, the guys, you know, we've been talking and the quota is 5 meetings a week. And you're kind of meeting that quota like every day and a half. And we think you're going to too many meetings. And we think you need to cut down on your meetings. And I was like, no, I need the meetings. And at that moment, I realized how important, you know, the meetings are to me. And he says, Kurt, there is more to life than AA. And at that moment, I was even more scared because all I had was AA. All I had was meetings. I didn't have anything else. And I said, no, AA is my life. And he says, no, there's more to life than AA. And we're screaming to each other, there's more to life than AA. AA is my life. And I felt like that guy from Officer and a Gentleman, where Richard Gere is out in the rain and the sergeant's like, why don't you quit? And Richard Gere's like, I got no place to go. And that's the way it was for me. This is the last house on the block. I had no place to go. And so, these little experiences helped me realize how important this fellowship was for me. and what it was doing for me. All those guys drank again. A number of years later, that chef, I met him over at 8111. I ran into him, and he was getting sober, and he said that he wanted to make amends to me for that moment. And I was like, no, you don't need to make amends to me. And he said, yeah, I do. I understand now. AA is my life. We shared about our drinking and how, but the effect that alcohol had on me and the way that it shattered me and the way that it affected me, that I was so addicted to it, that it's a miracle that I'm sober. I mean, that I'm standing here sharing honestly about these things with you guys. I didn't know how to be honest when I got sober. I didn't understand what honesty was. And I learned about it by listening to you share about yourself honestly. And I learned by identifying with hearing other alcoholics talk about their drinking experiences, your drinking experiences, what was real. And I couldn't differentiate that, what was real and what wasn't real. And I had to be able to have some help with that. And attending meetings, listening to alcoholics, and especially hanging out one-on-one with alcoholics has been a tremendous value. I had a sponsor who had about a year more sobriety than I did. And we used to go to meetings early and stay late. And that was kind of our thing at this group. It was, we were the ones that knew how to stay sober the best in AA. And so we were riding home one night, and he had a Ford Granada with a rusted hood and no air conditioning, no heat. And in the summertime, we rolled the windows down, and in the winter, we bundled up. And that was the most spiritual car that I had ever been in. I mean, we shared a lot, and we talked a lot. And I was trying to understand this. I was trying to get it. And I remember a lot of times saying, I want what you guys have. And they're like, you already have what we have. You haven't had a drink today. That's what we have. But I wanted to feel comfortable in my own skin. And they would say, and I'm like, I want to feel better. Oh. And these guys I ran around with would say, man, time takes time. I'm talking to somebody with 10 or 15 years of sobriety saying, I want to be like you. And you're like, you got like a year and a half, dude. I mean, you're supposed to be screwed up at a year and a half. You're supposed to be riddled with this thing. That's normal. But the recovery process for me has been a one day at a time thing. And it has never been by myself. It's always been with other alcoholics. I love going to meetings. I probably averaged a meeting a day since I've been in AA. My relationship with people in AA really defines my life. Having the experiences of getting close to people in AA. Some of them I've known since I've been in AA. There's a guy that I got sober with who, he and I got sober on the same day. And we talk on a regular basis, and we have the same conversation every time. How's it going, man? Good. How's it going? I hadn't had a drink today. No, me neither. Isn't it amazing? So we've been sober this long. Isn't that crazy? Yeah, it sure is. We had 16 years of sobriety. We're standing outside of a meeting. Okay, both of us were homeless when we got to AA. He's like he's a few years older than me. And he and I were talking, and my because I've been sober, I've got to experience a lot of things, and I tend to try not to talk about all of the extraneous stuff because of the precious nature of what has happened to me on the inside, where I have been able to stop fighting and stop thinking in such a sick way, and having relationships with my family. I have incredible relationships with my family. I have a son who's 15 years old. He turned 15 last week. You know, my brother, who didn't talk to me for the first 10 years I was sober, called me up and said, "Hey, let's get together." And I got off the phone. I started crying. I was like, "Oh my God, I'm sober, and this is why my brother wants to hang out with me." You know, the living amends of just staying sober and slowly keeping my mouth shut and not being a jerk to my family anymore, and that, you know, and the trust came back and all of that. So those are the really incredible things. But anyway, we're standing there, 16 years sober, and I was jet-setting around the world. I was doing a job that jet-setted me around the world. And he was, I said, so, and like I said, our conversations were about staying sober the whole time, for 16 years. And I said, "So what have you been doing with your life?" And he says, "Can you believe that I'm a doctor?" I'm like, "You're a doctor?" He says, "Yeah, I'm a doctor. I'm a freaking doctor. Remember Pride, Pocketbook, and Pedigree with me at the door?" And he says, "So what are you doing?" I'm like, I've gone to college too, and I did this and that. And he says, "You're doing that? You're traveling around the world?" "Yeah, I'm doing that. Can you believe it? I was in the London Stock Exchange the other day, and I'm thinking, I'm a drunk. And I'm sitting here with the vice president of the London Stock Exchange. How does this happen, you know?" Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I love being sober, and the kind of external things, or the rising phoenix kind of stuff that's happened to me because I'm sober. I've had a lot of different careers. I used to own a dance school, ballroom Latin swing. I can, if you guys want to have a dance lesson after the meeting, we could do that. We'll have the ladies on this side, gentlemen on that side. We'll have some fun. I used to be a radio talk show host. I've worked for a bunch of political campaigns. I've done a lot of things in my life. But to me, and I've traveled around the world. I've been traveling a lot lately. In the industry that I'm in now. I was in the film and television industry. I was in a film. I was a serial killer in a werewolf movie. It was a love story. My character's name was Cliff because he was on the edge. So that's that chapter. But really, when I look back on my life, what I think about is sitting with another alcoholic or coming to a meeting. When I think about traveling, I actually don't think about all of the stuff that happened at the places that I've been. I think about the meetings. It's amazing that I'd go to this meeting and I'd feel better, or I would identify with somebody around, you know, in a different place and hear them share ride to a meeting with this guy in England who had 30 something years, and we went meeting hopping. You know how we go bar hopping? Well, I never went bar hopping. I got sober when I was 17, but you know, we went meeting hopping, and that was more meaningful to me than riding the double decker bus and listening to somebody make fun of the Queen, right? I moved to this side of town. Recently, I moved here in, I think, March, and moved to Jasper. My family lives up there, and I moved up there. They asked me to come up there. The ones that had kicked me out, put a restraining order against me, protected themselves. They asked me to come up there because of what AA has done with me. And so I've been riding up and down this corridor, 515, 575, hitting all the different meetings, and I'm loving it. I love it. I went up to Blue Ridge on Sunday. I went to a great meeting in Blue Ridge, and then I went up there again on Monday. And then you know, we're going down to the Holly Springs, the one behind the firehouse, and it's just that's the best part of my life. Is being with you guys, the fellowship, It's an incredible thing. So, wow, 8 o'clock. We made it. I talked the whole time. Imagine that. Danny, thanks for asking me again. I appreciate it. It's good to see some faces that I recognize. That's it. Thank you.